Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm your host, Dr. Marty Gentius, and this week, contributing editor Tom Newman converses with Dr. Don Bubenzer, both of Kent State University, regarding the theory and practice of narrative therapy.
Well, I'm sitting with Dr. Bubenzer, and again, very gracious of you to take your time and sit down for a while here. I think the focus of today is we wanted to look at how narrative therapy has influenced your take on counseling in general.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You think you could start by giving maybe just some background information
Sure.
on your counseling experience?
I guess let me, and Tom, I appreciate the opportunity to be with you. This is Don Bubenzer. And, you know, let me share a little bit about my own narrative. I suppose I think that people choose any profession for somewhat personal reasons,
Sure.
and that can be harmful at times, but it can also provide a motivation that's very encouraging. And when I was in college, I was a sociology and a philosophy major. And at that time, my mother suffered from severe depression, enough that she had electroconvulsive therapy. And I'm sure, although I was not at home, that ultimately that played a part in
Sure,
my choice of a career. But I was much more into societal change. This was in the 60s, late 60s,
mm-hmm.
and it was a time certainly where upheaval and so forth in society was a part of it. And so I worked for a time for a Saul Alinsky organization. Saul Alinsky was a major, major social change person out of Chicago. And he had an organization in Buffalo. The acronym was BILD. I don't remember now what the title was. And, we would work for neighborhood change. I remember organizing a group of mostly grandmothers once to bring their rocking chairs and form a ring around a hospital that was designated for demolition. And they sat and rocked until it was called off, and in fact, that hospital still sits in the hardcore area of Buffalo today, serving the people in that community.
Mm-hmm.
And I went from there and worked in St. Louis on a project where they were working on urban renewal. And what we had noticed was that realtors seemed to be getting a tip-off on where the urban renewal was going to take place, which was illegal.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd go in and buy up all these apartments from poor people, and then urban renewal would come in and they'd turn around and sell them. And we exposed that in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and it was a really big deal. We did it through a lot of working on plats and seeing where property was moving and so forth. And it was one of those experiences that when you upset the establishment, you pay for it. One of the group of guys that I worked with was shot and killed shortly before that was exposed. So I was really into the social change piece, but I began to feel that I really wanted more personal contact. And although you worked on social change, it just seemed all you were doing was holding off things that were ultimately going to happen, and you weren't really, in my mind, advancing changes in society. Okay. Not that you do that through counseling either, although I think you certainly, as a counselor, always work for social change mm-hmm. and social justice. But I went out into counseling, I think partly then out of wanting to deal with my mother's experience with depression. And a little frustration with what happened as a part of community action activities. And so from that, I went into counseling. At that time, I did a lot of draft counseling for people who were wanting to deal with what were they going to do with being drafted into the military for Vietnam. And interestingly, we did a lot of problem pregnancy counseling because abortion was not a legal option, at least not in very many places. And in both instances, you kind of had underground railroads that you worked for folks who felt they simply did not want to go in the military. You had ways of working with those people to get them signed up with draft boards that were pretty liberal or get them to Canada. And with women who felt that abortion was the action they wanted to take with their pregnancy. And we, in both instances, dealt with people who were wanting to go into military or keep a child. You had ways of assisting them to find places where they could have an abortion. I saw sometimes as many as 12 clients a day.
Wow.
And after a while in doing that, now I'd had some training for that. I had a master's in divinity, and so I'd had some training in counseling and done an internship at St. Louis State Hospital. But I started feeling like, you know, this is meaningful work. I felt I was doing things with people that was meaningful to them, but I needed more training.
Okay, and I have to wonder a little bit, in addition to your personal drive towards counseling, I think, were any part of the, I guess, the chaotic times in which you were in and seeing a lot of people maybe with less to hold on to than generations before had had, the need for seeking some understanding?
Well, I think certainly most, and this is probably ultimately some of my attraction to a narrative approach. Okay. A lot of a narrative approach has to do with people who are trying to find meaning in their life and how can they live so that they can live in meaningful ways. And of course, the folks that you were dealing with, whether it was Vietnam or problem pregnancies or whatever, were usually discussions of meaning. And so that part of it, and I guess with my background in philosophy, had a background in theology, all of those kind of are probably some of my narrative of why narrative therapy ultimately was a place that I settled in.
Could you explain for me a little bit about maybe the underlying concepts of narrative therapy?
I can. I guess one of the things I feel is that narrative is intuitive with people. If you talk to little kids, they always have a narrative about who they're going to be in life. You were going to be a cowboy or a rancher or I was always going to be in wildlife management some way. And you not only have an endpoint, you usually have some story about how you're going to do there, and even things that you're doing at the time. I was always going around trying to start little fires where I would cook food over it, and some, and that was part of my story of who I wanted to be as a in wildlife management. Now, when I realized later you had to deal with cells and a lot of stuff in biology and not just field work, it kind of turned sour on me. But there's an intuitive process to narrative where I think that people have somewhere they're going in life. And that people who are stuck either are going somewhere they don't want to end up or they need a new dream. And so I think a lot of narrative work is awakening the dreams of unfulfilled pasts, I suppose, in some way. And so a primary assumption, and narrative work is really tied to social construction to me, is that any circumstance can be described in an infinite variety of ways. And so maybe a certain event has a meaning in one story and a different meaning in another story in some way. Where maybe starting fires and cooking food has a part in a story of being a wildlife manager, but it may also have a part of being resourceful and a leader in some other story.
Okay.
So the same event can be told in different ways, and that's really where the hope in life comes from, that if life was so set that a particular set of circumstances generated a specific outcome, we wouldn't need any counseling.
Okay.
And it's the idea that we can alter the meanings of events in our lives to fit a new end goal that gives people hope in some ways.
So while the events may remain the same or unchanged, the way we look at them or the way we ascribe meaning to our place in it or how it came into our lives
may change. And you may even remember different events, depending on your story. For example, when 9-1-1 occurred, at least for me, there was a moment of hopefulness in that because I felt like as a country, we might realize we need to reach out and be partners with a lot of people in the world and take on a partnership where we didn't feel like we needed the boss and other people needed to respond to us, but we needed to work with other people on finding solutions. But we got it kind of shadowed with the terror idea of it, and so we went into a pretty a stance where we were going to protect ourselves. And so, if anything, we built up our idea that we know best of how things should go forth. And so it really was, how did you interpret that event? If you saw it a call to be a neighbor, to reach out, to establish relationships and partners around the world, you would take one course of action. If you saw it as a threat, that we better hold on to everything we've got because somebody else wants it and they don't deserve it because we earned it, you took another stance. And in my mind, unfortunately, that's the one we've taken. But you can see the same event could be used in very different ways and different stories that one might have.
And also that that narratives aren't just individual things. That
communities
are national.
Yeah.
You know,
you see that with counseling departments. Counseling departments have stories about themselves as to who students are and who faculty happen to be. And are they super academic or are they helpful and focused on counseling? And so anywhere you go, there's both individual stories, although I would claim that stories are never individual, and collective stories at any level of society.
How would you explain that, that it's not an individual concern?
Well, you asked a while ago about the principles of narrative therapy, and one of them would be that there's nothing in life that demands a specific explanation. Another is that you can't, the explanations of life are social. You can't hold, or one can't hold, their own individual view of life. Other people have to buy into that view, or you won't be able to hold it. I mean, we really, you might say, well, a hermit has an individual view of life. But if society didn't accept hermiting as a possible way of living, it wouldn't exist. And so any story that we have, any way we define life has a social element. It's agreed upon.
I think I remembered you saying at one time that I may have the concept that I'm funny. But if no one around me ever laughs at anything I say, that I may find myself altering the story of myself.
I probably couldn't hold that story too long.
All right. Are there any other underlying concepts you think that are?
Well, I guess besides the idea that you know, events can be explained in multiple ways and understood in multiple ways, and that it has to have a social understanding before it becomes an understanding. The whole idea then of really thinking about what story you want to live is important. And so the reflecting upon the outcome of one's story and who you want to be, that's a pretty powerful piece and pretty important. I was just doing a workshop with medical students a couple of weeks ago in which we were talking about, well, what kind of a physician do they want to be? Because they are all working in practices where they see different atmospheres around practices.
Okay.
And so the whole realization that they could determine or be a part of their future in relation with other physicians is kind of freeing and opening in some ways. And so the explanations we have about the future are very important in thinking about those. Is 911 a call to be a good neighbor and to be a part of the world, or is it a call to be apart from the world? If you are influenced by the terror and we got to hold on to it, you live one story. And so the explanation of the event determines how you want to live. But the reflection on how you want to live is critical.
Okay. Maybe even
so, there's kind of four principles there. One of them is events can be explained in multiple ways. Mm-hmm. There have to be at least a social understanding before the explanation can fly. The explanation you have really determines your future.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, going back to that example, one example, you're going to put all of your money into the arms race. In the other one, you're going to put a lot more money into the solidarity race in some ways. And yet the reflection on it of who you want to be is critical. So kind of the four principles there.
Okay. And how have these principles affected or related to counseling for you?
Well, you know, I'm at an age where I've been through many evolutions of counseling, and some that resonate better with you than others in parts of them. When I began my counseling training, Rogers was really the hub. He was still alive. He was a big change from what we had had with Freud and so forth, but he was a big influence. And so I was certainly trained with Rogers.
Okay.
And then we got into Gestalt therapy, came on the scene, Fritz Perls to a great extent, and so I had that background. And then I got very much into family therapy and systems and so forth. And so structural strategic therapy was very influential. But in Gestalt and structural strategic, the therapist is really the expert in bringing about the change.
Sure.
And so there is an element in that that's very exciting and elevating, and yet I feel it's somewhat disrespectful of the person,
okay,
the client. And so I always had a little disconnect. There was that sense of power and in some respect, but it didn't seem like the way, if you're wanting to help people, you treat people. And so with the constructionist therapies, I also had a dose of Adler in there, whom I still like very much for his concept of social interest, that if it's not in social interest in my mind, it's not good. And so that resonation also kind of went along with my interest then in narrative approaches, because narrative approaches really lift the expertness of the client. Who do they want to be? And how do we help them to become that in some way? Now, it involves a kind of a choice of an end point. You can't have a story without knowing who you want to become. You're going to be a cowboy. Now, what do I need to do to get there? And so you are asking clients, who do they want to become? And what do they need to do to become that? And really the focus is on, when have they been that in the past? And so that really means part of their going back and reinterpreting their past, or drawing their past forth with another story about it that leads them to the goal of where they're going to.
Okay.
Now, it's not quite that simple, Tom, in that a lot of people have had some severe traumas in life that have certainly pushed their story in directions that they may not want to go. And the simply setting of, I want to be this person and I'm going to do that, often does not work. You often have to deconstruct, take apart some very traumatic events that people have had in life and interpret them differently. For example, a woman who has experienced sexual molestation will often, even though she may not verbalize it, feel that she was a part of that molestation, even though she might have been 7 or 8 years old when it occurred. And so you really do have to go back and help that person interpret or deconstruct that event so that they can move forward to becoming who they are. But ultimately, it's about how do you help people construct the life they want to live? Pretty exciting stuff.
I would imagine, yeah.
Pretty much, you know, what story are you wanting to be? Who do you see yourself as being? Now, I don't know. Constructionism is a little heady, and so we talk about the construction of reality. I myself feel a little more comfortable with a little more humble place in that there are many realities available to us. Which do we kind of want to draw forth for ourselves in some way? There's just a little change. There's a respectfulness in the drawing forth motif that I don't quite feel when I think I'm going to go construct reality in some way.
How would you see the therapist's role in that drawing forth of a differing reality for a client?
Well, I guess... I don't completely draw away from the idea of having expertise, but my expertise, I would hope, is how to engage in conversation with people that helps them to define the story that they want to live, who they want to be, what they want to do in life, and then where has that story been present all along? Because it's a lot easier to work with a story that's already there.
Okay.
And then how do you nurture that through the questions you ask or through the connections you might draw between events, the pulling forth? We're all multi-storied, and so the pulling forth the portions of the story that support the story that they want to live. And then you get into the reflection of how do they describe life and is it really the life they want to live and what will be the concerns that they might have if they live that life. And so it's kind of a reflective conversation that goes on. You're not usually into big scenes of catharsis or anything like that. It's a more quiet and thoughtful and who do people want to be approach.
What would you say, really, are some of the benefits to the client if they were to seek out someone versed in the narrative approach?
You know, I let me sidestep that for just a second. And I suppose this is a part of me that I think there always have to be benefits for the therapist. And the benefit is in working with clients in this way, you continually think about the story that you're living and want to live as a counselor. And the richness is that you get to see how other people live their stories and deal with life. And all of that's very uplifting for you as a counselor. Now, the benefits for the client, I think, would be the same thing. That folks may, as you loosen the demons of the past, certainly feel freed or forgiven or forgiving. And those are all experiences that help people feel more settled and grounded and confident and comfortable. Then when you think about, well, I also get to choose the part of the world that I feel I want to be a part of, and get to work towards that story that I want to live, it's very uplifting for clients. They get excited about themselves. It's pretty freeing when you think that, you know, I can spend my time being and drawing forth the story that I want to have in life. I think that Michael White, who is probably the best-known narrative therapist, would really take that to heart. He runs a practice in Adelaide, Australia, and he works a good bit with Aboriginal populations who don't have ways to pay for the work that he does. And so he travels the country, world, doing workshops and so forth, and he uses the money from those workshops to keep his practice alive and helpful in a population in a country or part of a country where it can't support that.
I'm coming back.
Well, he's thought pretty carefully about what who he wants to be and how he wants to use and steward the resources available to him. And so I think people feel their lives are enriched. And, you know, you talk about, and certainly I think narrative works well with people who ask questions of meaning in their life. And Bruner certainly talks about a landscape of action and a landscape of meaning. But I don't think you have one apart from the other. We talk about people who are not introspective and they're into doing. But there's a pattern to their doing and there's a commitment to what they're about. And so the therapy in my mind really, you know, we just don't work with people who can't make their life a little bit better. From their
That's
perspective.
A pretty short list, I
guess. Yeah, you know, when you think about who can't do that, really, if they can't do that at all, they're probably not walking around in society. And so I think it's really an applicable therapy. Now, certainly, it doesn't, it can clash a bit with the business of therapy that gets into the diagnostic business, but they can be compatible. You can work side by side.
And that was one of, I think, the most interesting parts of it to me is that the language and the ideas behind it seem they're almost maybe even opposed to pathologizing people or behavior, as you were talking about the benefits for the client. That maybe you could explain it better than me as I'm thinking about it, but instead of seeing the person as being a problem, that perhaps just meaning attached to events in their lives or to the direction they see themselves going, it kind of moves that outside of who the person is. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
That's correct. You know, diagnosis itself is a story. When we diagnose somebody, we've got the elements of a story in a book, and then we see if those elements are present in that person's life, and then we call them schizophrenic. That's the title of their story. You know, they also have other things present in their life besides those symptoms, and we can actually group those together in some ways, too, and give them a title and work towards better ends with them. Now, I'm not at all opposed to medication. I think medication can be extremely helpful in with people developing the story they want to live, but I am highlighting that diagnosis is not reality. It's a story, and it's a set of symptoms that we pull together and then define a person with that label. Okay. But that person is many other things, too.
So maybe instead of focusing on that particular portion of the story that some therapies may focus on, schizophrenia, a narrative therapist may try to draw out the parts that aren't focused around that diagnosis.
That's true, although some of the parts that are people's symptoms of anxiety and so forth, they are part of their story. I wouldn't want to deny that in any ways, and may spell out limitations for people at times. But given those symptoms, they also still have a lot of room for more story in their life. And if we just focus on that dominant problem-saturated story, we can get further into that. If we can focus on some times when they're a little less anxious or change the kind of voices that people hear or let them talk about other times when they don't hear voices or when they hear voices more helpful to them, and those are not my ideas. Those are actually strategic people talk about those things. We can begin to draw forth and enlarge more useful stories to them in their life.
Well, that's very, very interesting. I think for me, it's almost inextricably brought together that the two things that have fascinated me that I've heard you speak about are first the narrative approach and second, the use of letters in both therapeutic and in personal meanings. I don't know if you see those as closely related maybe as I've taken them to be, but in hearing you talk about how you've used letters in your life, you know, is really, I don't know, maybe got me pondering my own narrative in a lot of different ways as a growing counselor, as a person involved in the lives of the people around me. Could you share a little bit about what makes letters so powerful?
Mm-hmm. Well, they may not be so powerful for everybody, mm-hmm. although I think actually letters are becoming more powerful. We live in a world of junk mail and emails, and both are often kind of cheap. Junk mail, obviously, just trying to get us to buy into the story that we have about our economy and what we need in life. And emails are often fairly thoughtless. And I know I've pushed the button to send an email when I wish I could pull it back and think a little bit more about it.
I don't know anything about that.
So to take the time to write a letter, it's almost like doing therapy. It's as enriching for the therapist as it is perhaps for the client. Writing letters, whether it's therapeutic or personal, they're both therapeutic. I hope for the person that receives them. They're always therapeutic for me as a writer. When I write letters to clients, of course, I do it really as the records I keep on clients. Certainly, insurance may require us to keep some information, mm-hmm. Although any information I have on a client, I want to be their information. I want to be able to share it with a client.
Okay.
And so what I would do, and this is really drawing again on the work of Michael White and David Epstein, is after a session, I will write the client a letter. The benefit of it for me is that in thinking about the client and who they want to be and how they are becoming that, I become much closer to the client. Sometimes there are clients that you don't feel like you get to know very well,
mm-hmm.
Maybe because of how they present themselves and maybe because of a little difficulty I have in receiving it at times. And yet to sit down quietly for a half hour after a session and begin to think about their life and who they want to be, what's happened in their life that has influenced that, and then to begin to write to them in ways that affirm them for who they want to be and how what they're doing is helping them to become that, I think is affirming to them. Clients obviously say that when they come in, but it's equally affirming to me as a counselor because I think it's important that you care about clients. And if I have a client I don't have enough caring about, then writing a letter often will let me care about them a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I'm very aware that there are boundaries between clients and me as a counselor, and I don't have any, that doesn't get in the way of that.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can care and want the best for my client, genuinely the best for my client, I'm a lot better therapist. And so letter writing helps with that. Now, I write letters in daily life just to help people, I think, to take pause maybe in their life to appreciate who they are and the world that they're living in, to think about the world that they're living in. We had a daughter who got married last summer, and I wrote her a letter because I thought it allowed me to get closer to her. And I think I wrote things that helped her to become wedded to her husband and him to her in ways that would be helpful to them. And so you do have an end goal in mind that I want them to have a successful and good relationship. And are there things that I remember out of her life that I think I can lift up that would help her to do that and to develop connections with them that I think are helpful in some ways. And so to write someone on a birthday or an anniversary or a special occasion in their life, I think, can be a nodal ritual event for them. Likewise, to write people out of the blue. I certainly have done that before and received it, where I might have observed somebody lead a meeting that I thought the way they did it was just superb. And so to send a brief thank you to them and note what you thought they did that you really appreciated and how helpful it was, it's major impact. Or anytime you get a chance to write, I write in a little internal in-house newsletter. And you'd feel like, oh, to have to do that 8 times a year is a burden, but it's an opportunity to say something that might make a difference in this context. And the people that write back about what you read, it's fulfilling. It does make a difference. And their writing back makes a difference to me. It's a social network you build for yourself.
Sure. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of tying together, I guess, a lot of things as I listen to, I hear, you know, the social interest and those around you that you're helping to construct and draw positive meanings, in a manner of speaking, from things that you've experienced with them, from either all the way through their lives or just having sat through a meeting that they attended, that there's a way to reach out and affect people's lives.
And the narrative, it's a story. And almost anybody you meet, I've got a story about them. I think everybody does. You know, Tom, I guess one of the things, Tom is a kind of a gourmet cook. And I was ill this past fall and had to be home for a few days. And I read this story about this gourmet meal that these guys had gathered for in France. And one of the dishes that they cooked was baby pig snouts floating in soup, which didn't sound very appetizing to me. And I shared that with Tom, the cook. And he said, yeah, there is a brand of food preparation in which the chef tries to use every bit of the animal that's available and to make that just as appetizing as any other part of that animal. And they do it out of reverence for the animal. Well, you know, that's a pretty profound story. And certainly brings home what we eat in a personal way, but also in a very enriching way. And it really was a nice little moment of a 2-minute discussion that will probably stay with me the rest of my life. And not only for the story, but I guess for what it says about you, you know, that if there's a reverence in knowing the stories, and then there's a reverence in using the food, and not only for nourishment of our body, but appreciation for the world that we live in.
For where it comes, yeah.
And I'm not sure that everybody would pick up on that part of the story if they're a chef, but you did. Yeah. And you used that for my benefit. Changed it from something I was kind of distasteful of to something that I might think was a privilege. In a way.
Well, yeah, I think I appreciate those thoughts. Kind of off my track now, but
well, one of the things you kind of wonder, how would you write a letter to a person? And what was going through my mind then was, if I were to write you a letter of what I know about you, that would be a piece in it, and I could write other pieces about it. Interestingly, one of our secretaries is just now trying to plan a year-end party, and she would like to have place mats for each person in the building. There's 120 that would have little statements that were appreciative of that person. And so she asked me last night, could I write a few things for people? And out of her list of 120 or so, I probably could write something about 80 of those folks.
Wow.
And, you know, you notice things in life, and they are a part of the story you have about those people. Now, what you notice makes a difference, because I could notice things about folks that I didn't care for too.
Sure.
But in this instance, if you're paying attention to things you like, they'll get a little bump in their life about reading those things. It's neat.
And do you,
so there were 80 little bitty letters that I might have written to these folks. Wow.
Do you find that it changes your everyday relationship with people then?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I did that last night. It didn't take you that long. I was just writing a sentence or two about them or a few phrases. And so today when I come into work, I notice those people I've written about. And I feel very warm about all of them. And so I'll say something today like, I noticed one of them had on a new pair of shoes today that I thought was kind of neat. And you could see she took pride in. And I probably wouldn't have noticed those if I hadn't written about her last night. So it's a way, a kind of a spiritual way to kind of stay connected with things, pay attention to things in ways that I hope are helpful.
I think, you know, we're probably drawing nigh to our time. I just wanted to see if there was anything else that you think, if you imagine somebody listening to this at some point down, maybe a little bit of a verbal letter, what would you recommend to beginning counselors, to have been around for a while counselors, to those that teach them? What kind of words would you have to offer?
Well, I guess first it's a little hard to think that anybody might want to listen to this, although it's been an experience, a lot like I said, when you write a letter or when you sit with a client, that it's kind of a holy spot just to have take the time out to be able to talk, and so that's really nice.
I agree.
And what I would say to counselors is, I suppose, notice what you notice. You can notice things about people and clients that are helpful to them. And you can notice things that kind of dig deeper holes. And I guess through some of the stages of my therapy, I think I noticed things that dug deeper holes. That in some ways, being the expert counselor who brings about change leaves the client at a lesser level than you. And so I notice then things about them that they need to change, and I'm the person who can just do that for them.
Okay.
Whereas with a narrative approach, I notice things about them that they want to change, and then I notice where they've done that already and just help draw that to their attention. And it's a very different process, a very different world to live in. And it's not just therapy, it's a way to live. I think the folks who work in Narrative White and a whole lot of other people realize it's just a better way to live. It's the 911 where other people are living lives that if you want to be a part of their life, they'll want to be a part of your life, and we sure need a lot of that.
Absolutely. Well, let me just again thank you for not only for your time and wisdom today, but on many occasions, and I hope that that your words are taken and reflected on by a great number of people, that social interest often goes places that maybe we don't expect it to go, or places we never would have thought. So, again, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
You've just heard Dr. Don Bubenzer of Kent State University speak about narrative therapy with our contributing editor, Tom Newman. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselaraudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4015. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.